All right, now let's get on to business. Our speaker tonight, I thought he was from a different group, but because I remember when we asked Willie to come out before, he was from Together We Can, but he's been Central for a long time, so it's been that long since he's been back here, I guess. So help me welcome our speaker from the Central Group of Alcoholics, Thomas Willie B. Willie.
Oh dear. First of all, before I get started, I owe this group an apology. I was asked to speak here 2 years ago and I got lost. You know, for me that's nothing unusual, because for years when I was drinking, there was as many people said to me, why don't you get lost? I still do it. But since I missed the one 2 years ago, Will has agreed to allow me to speak tonight for 2 hours instead of one. And I would need that, trust me. My name is Willie Burns, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very grateful, recovered alcoholic. And I feel that I have to warn you that where I come from, in the west of Scotland, I've been accused of being a big book thumper. And that's a charge that I plead guilty to, with no apologies, none at all. I'm one of these guys, you know, if it's not in this book, don't tell me about it. Because this is a book that saved my life and changed my life. And it makes my life worth living. I'd really like to spend all the time I have tonight telling you about the miracle of my sobriety. And that's what it is. And that's not a word that I use lightly. You know, it's impossible for me to be standing here tonight. Next month I'll have 28 years of sobriety. I never thought I would ever see 6 months, I can assure you. But if there's anybody in the room tonight, you know, who's having trouble maybe staying sober, or who's fairly new, this talk is for you. That's why I'm here. You know, let me be your guinea pig. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. My whole life today centers around AA, and it has done for years. And I would love to be able to stand here and tell you that from the very first time I came to AA, that I've never had a drink, and that everything in my life has been wonderful. But that's not true. That's not true. I probably qualify for the Guinness Book of Records for the number of times I went in and out of AA. I think it's only fair to tell you that the worst part of my life started after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The worst part. Until I found this program. Just to give you a brief thumbnail sketch of the background, I was the only boy in a family of 6 girls, had 6 sisters. 3 of them are dead now through alcoholism. 2 of them died by cancer. One left who has got cancer and leukemia right now. Both my parents were alcoholic. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I'm sure some of you can identify with that. And I saw all the hell and the trouble that drinking caused. And I remember even in my early teens, you know, I vowed, I'll never drink. And I meant it. Because I saw all the hell that was going on. I left high school at 18. But a month before I was due to graduate. And I did that despite my father. Because I hated him. I intended to become a draftsman. I had a job lined up with Rolls Royce. And they were willing to pay all my university expenses for the next 7 years, providing I signed a contract to stay with them for 5 years after I finished. I thought, no way. I ain't tying myself down for 12 years. See, from the age of 15, in the evenings and weekends, I'd been working in the gambling industry in betting shops. And the time I was 18, I'd met a girl. She was only 16. We got married. And within a year, I'd moved down to London. where I was put in charge of a whole string of betting shops. There was about 40 of them, and I was only 19, and that was good for my ego. And the reason for that was that the gambling industry had been legalised in Scotland for about 5 or 6 years before it was legalised in England. So whenever it was legalised in England, they couldn't find experienced staff. So we were all headhunted. That's how I got the job in London. I worked in the gambling industry for about 20 odd years. And every bookmaker that I worked for, I robbed them blind. And I never get caught once. Not once. I didn't start drinking until I was about 21, 22. I was down in London, and I remember the effect that it had on me. You know, the effect that Dr. Saltworth talks about in the doctor's opinion, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. You know, it was magic stuff to me. It really was, you know. All the years I've been around the AA, I've heard a lot of guys in the room saying that when they were drinking, they thought they were God's gift to women. I never thought that. I knew it. I was only drinking maybe 6-7 years, and my wife at that time, all her family were good, devout Catholics. You know, her parents didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't gamble, didn't do anything. You know, and I was forever being compared, you know, look at the harm that drink has done to your family, and look at my family, and I resented that. You know, I really did. So say my drinking career at that time only lasted 6-7 years. But it was out of control. So they thought. I thought it was fine. I was having a ball. It was great. They arranged for me to go and see a Catholic priest. You'll hear quite a bit tonight about Catholic priests, but there was no sexual abuse. Sorry to disappoint you. But this guy I was sent to see, he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and his name was Father Isaac McLaren. And Isaac McLaren will never be dead as long as I'm alive. But I remember that first night I went to see him, it was about 20 odd miles away from where I live. And we're sitting across from each other in the big room, and he starts telling me a lot about his drinking experience. Then out of the blue he said to me, "Willie, do you not think you may have a drink problem?" I felt insulted. I really did. And I remember saying to him, "No, I can't be alcoholic. I'm far too intelligent." He said, "Yes, son, you're so intelligent. You can't count to one. If you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk." And again, I remember coming back to him and saying, you know, I don't drink the cheap wine and beer like the down and outs in the streets. I said, it's nothing but the best for me. And he said, but alcohol is not a drink. It's a drug called ethanol or ethyl alcohol. He said, like every drink in the market today, there is a certain population, proportionally the population, who will be allergic to that drink, to that drug. And he said it's the same drug that's in the cheapest wine and beer as what's in the most expensive whiskey. You know, and again, you know, I come back at him again and I said, you know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I've got too much money. But it was all my employer's money. And he said, well, just keep drinking, son, and won't last you long. I thought, you... I couldn't get away from the guy quick enough that night. And you know where I went. The nearest bar. It was only about a year later. I was involved in a very serious car accident. And to this day, I've got no recollection of what happened. But I remember distinctly my first recollection after that accident. I remember another Catholic priest standing over me, giving me the last rites. I remember that. I remember a big black doctor standing over me with a clipboard, asking me a load of stupid questions like, do you know what your name is? Do you know what happened to you? And all I had to do was just look around the bed, the hospital bed, that I was tied into. Both my legs were in traction, both my arms were in plaster. It's a matter of medical record. I had over 250 stitches from there up. They tell me I had to be cut out of the car. My ribs were broken. My pelvis was broken. I broke my right thigh in four places, my right shin in three, and I broke every bone in my right ankle. And I was told I'd never walk again without a steel caliper. My attitude all my life was, I'll show them. I'll show them. And I lay in that bed in Glasgow Royal Infirmary for 4.5 months with two chest expanders, one at the top of the bed and one at the bottom of the bed, day and night. You know, and I straightened my arm. Even today, 40 years later, I've still got a sensation of pins and needles in the palm of my hand. They would give me a little sponge ball that I could squash with two fingers in this hand, but in my right hand I couldn't budge it. And at that time, my wife used to come in and see me twice a day. In the first few weeks, she was always dressed in black. There was a lot of people praying for me at that time. But I'm sure that most of them were praying that I wouldn't make it. Mm-hmm. That somebody up there likes me, you know, still here. Eventually they allowed me home still with a traction on my leg. That lasted about the best part of a year. Then I had to undergo extensive physiotherapy for about another year and learn to walk again. I've now got one high heel. And if I didn't tell you that, you wouldn't know. Okay? But backtrack. While I was in Glasgow Royal Infirmary, that priest that gave me the last rites, he was the hospital chaplain in his parish, was straight across the road in St. Mungo's Parish in Glasgow. And he would come in and sit with me almost every night. And we became good friends. Eventually, after about a year or so, whenever I was allowed home, he used to come out from Glasgow maybe once a month and visit me. Then it became once a week. Then it was two or three nights a week. Eventually, I get back to work. Of course, the drinking started again. And again, you know, the atmosphere at home, you could have cut the atmosphere with a knife. You know, it was, wow, a no-go area. We had three children within 2 years and 10 months of being married. And after, I didn't realise that at the time, but after my youngest daughter was born, our married life, our sex life was finished because she was a devout Catholic. And I don't use that as an excuse, that's a fact. And I don't use it to justify my own behaviour. But I'm in my early 20s and I'm living down in London. You know, in the swinging 60s, a permissive society, and I was, you know. Eventually, again, you know, she'd contacted a member of AA who lived in the area. And him and another guy came over one Sunday afternoon to take me to my very first AA meeting. That was 1973. And again, they drove me about 25, 30 miles away. And I'm sitting in this room and I didn't know anybody. And the meetings at home in Scotland, they last 2 hours. You get a chairman and a speaker for the first hour, then the second hour they go around the room. And I have no idea what was said. But in the second part of that meeting, it seemed as though everybody in that room knew about me. Because they were all taking it in turns to have a go at me by saying things that I had done when I was drinking. And I'm sitting there, you know, the whiz kid, and I'm racking my brain trying to think, how did they know about me? How did they know about me? And to show you how clever I was, I thought, you know, they must think I'm stupid. They really must think my head buttons up the back. When I've left the house, she's been on the phone to them and told them all about me, and they've got together and they've said, now, when it's your turn, you say this, and it's your turn, you say that. I wouldn't want you to think I was paranoid. That's the way it was. It was suggested to me at that time that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And to the best of my recollection, I did that. 90 meetings in 90 days. I remember that night, after 90 days, I've got my wife and the kids in the car and I'm taking her down to see her parents. And I stopped at a liquor store. And I said, well, you know, that's it. I mean, I've done it now. 90 meetings, I'm cured. So I'll just go in and get a quarter bottle of whiskey. And she didn't go ballistic like she normally did. Because by that time, she'd be going to Al-Anon. And she said, well, Willie, if that's what you want to do, you carry on. And I didn't know that quarter bottle of whiskey was going to be the start of me going in and out the doors of AA for the next 12 years. 12 years. And during that 12-year period, I never ever got another 90 days. Never. You know, some of the guys in the meetings would say to me, "How long are you back for this time, Willie?" You know, I might be back for a few days or a couple of weeks, and I would always get drunk again. And I couldn't understand it. Because, I mean, I've said it for years, I've never met anybody with more willpower and determination than this wee guy standing here right now. You tell me I can't do something, just stand back. I'll show you. The old attitude. And I wasn't trying, you know, to get drunk. I can't explain it. You know, the harder I tried not to drink, the more I ended up drinking. You know. And the guys in the rooms, they told me, you know, the things that would happen to me if I kept on drinking. They called them the yets. And I didn't want these things to happen to me, I can assure you. But gradually, over the next 12 years, I lost my wife, my kids, my home, my jobs. I lost two businesses. I became unemployed and unemployable. I did quite a number of one-night stands in police stations. And I ended up in Sauchon Prison in Edinburgh. I got banned for drunk driving twice. The second time was for 3 years. And it's mandatory. You don't get any time off for good or bad behaviour. You know, that was it. But that time I owned a taxi business. And I was still working in the gambling industry, but I started this taxi business at night because to try and stop myself drinking. Because, I mean, if you drive, you don't drink. Right? Wrong. It was a nightmare. An absolute nightmare. The only thing I did right during that 12-year period was I kept going back to AA because I knew that there had to be an answer, even for an idiot like me. But to give you an idea what the meetings were like in the west of Scotland at that time, and this is not a criticism of the way they were, these are observations based on my own personal experience. A lot of the meetings I went to, nobody spoke about the big book. Well, there was one guy. This guy was 29 years dry. And in the area, everybody looked up to Big Frank. He was Mr. AA. And I've often heard this guy saying, you know, "Oh, I've never read the big book. I didn't want to become an expert." You know, and all we listened to for the 12 years was war stories. So many meetings that we went to, anybody in the room that mentioned God or higher power or Jesus Christ, you were asked to leave the room. Mm-hmm. We're not here for that nonsense. We're only here for booze. You know, and I'm going in and out the doors and I'm demented. My life is going to hell in a handbasket. And I remember one night pleading with an old guy in the room, and I'm saying to him, you know, "I know this is a program of change, but how do you change?" The old guy patted me on the back and he said, "Well, I just keep coming back, son. You'll change in spite of yourself." You know, he was right. I got worse. The night of my last drink was on the 23rd of March 1985, and I remember that night, you know, I'm lying on the edge of my bed. I was living alone, as I'm still on my own. I have been since I've been sober, through choice. And I'm lying on the edge of my bed and I'm bringing up pints of blood. And I remember that was probably the very first time that I've said the most honest prayer that I've ever said in my life. And I said, "God, for F's sake, help me." The next morning, there was a guy came to my house. And his name was Andy Davison. And Andy brought with him a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had his book lying at home for 7 years, never looked at the damn thing. Never looked at it, you know. And Andy started, he was a long time sober. Andy didn't even have 15 months at that time. And Andy started telling me about this book, that this is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tells you that down there. And a textbook is a book to be studied and referred back to. And the tremendous hope that Andy gave me that day was when he opened the book up to the very first page, and up there it says in big letters, Alcoholics Anonymous. Then underneath it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered. Past tense. Have recovered. But he was quick to add that the word recovered doesn't mean cured. And it tells me that in the book as well. And it was read out at the start of the meeting. That all I have is a daily reprieve. But the word recovered just simply means to get well. And for my money, one of the great statements in this book is the one that says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man's mind, and every woman's as well, that you can get well, regardless of anyone, that all you have to do is trust in God and clean house. And Andy took me to chapter 5 in the book, you know, and again he started going through it slowly and explaining parts of it to me. Now, after having told me that I can recover from this illness, in chapter 5 it tells me that not everybody in AA is going to make it. Not everybody. It tells you that in chapter 5. Because in there it says, those who do not recover. So there are those who will, and there are those who won't. But it goes on to say, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And Andy told me this was a manual of instruction. All the instructions are laid out for each and every one of us in black and white. You know, this is the owner's manual. And it tells me what to do, when to do it, how to do it. What will happen when I do these things, when I take these steps, and what will happen if I don't take these steps. And he suggested to me that I start and study this book no more than 2 pages a day and to believe every word in it. After having gone in and out of AA for 12 years, this really was the last chance saloon for this meat guy. And as it says in the book, you know, I was as convinced as a dying man, you know, that this would work for me. You see, I thought that just by going to meetings and saying, my name is Willie, I'm an alcoholic, I thought I was doing something about the first step. That's not what the first step says. The first step asked me, you know, asked me to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't even know what made me powerless over alcohol. That's the things I had to find out. And I found it out through the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters in this book. Dr. Siltwell explains, you know, that I've got an allergy of my body. To be honest, for years, while I'm going in and out, I'd heard people talking about this allergy, but I thought it was just a plausible excuse. I didn't believe anything they told me in the AA meetings. You know, I didn't trust them. And most of all, I didn't trust myself. But, you know, once I saw it written down in black and white, and once I realised that this book was written before I was even born, that was the clincher for me. You know, even today, common sense tells me, if you're allergic to penicillin, you don't take penicillin. If you're allergic to strawberries, you don't eat strawberries. So that wee part of it made sense. My body is allergic to alcohol. So because of that, I can't drink. But that's only part of why I am powerless over alcohol, because, again, Dr. Siltwell explains that I've got a mental obsession. The book talks about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That's me. Is that someday, somehow, I'll be able to do just 2 things. I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And he goes further because he says, the persistence of this illusion, all in the mind, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Then, as Keith read out earlier, I learned that I had to fully concede to my innermost self. It's in here, not up here. That's the thing that got me in trouble all my life. I had to learn to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. That's the first step in recovery. The second part of the first step, that my life had become unmanageable. My life became unmanageable because I was powerless over alcohol. Because of the allergy, I couldn't drink. Because of the obsession, I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop from starting again. My starter was broke. You know, You know, I had somebody saying, you know, a man takes a drink, then a drink takes a drink, then a drink takes a man. And that's the way it was for me. The second step in our program was the single most difficult one for this wee guy. Because in there it says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. You see, I didn't believe in a power greater than myself. I was brought up to believe in this God of hellfire and damnation. I knew since I was that size, I was going to roast in hell for the things I had done. You know, all my life, any time I had done anything wrong, and that was on a regular basis, the local priest would be sent for, and I'd be sat down, and the finger would be pointed at me, and I felt that size. You know, there is guilt, and there is Catholic guilt. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about. You know? But again, thank God for this book, because Bill Wilson, in his wisdom, he tells me that I can choose any conception of God that I like, providing it makes sense to me. Andy Davison said that he kept talking to me about this loving God. You know, the one they talk about in the second tradition, the boss in AA. There's but one ultimate authority, that's the boss, a loving God. And Andy said, but that God that you believed in, he didn't work for you. Why don't you pick a different one? And that didn't really make sense till I read the book. And gradually, you know, I began to believe that there was a loving God that could love me. You know. And even in trying to find him, you know, again, the book makes it so simple. It says God does not make hard terms for anyone who seeks him. And certainly in my case, what seemed at first to be a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving hand of God. Could restore me to sanity. Well, I don't do the daft, stupid, crazy things that I did all the years I was drinking. And he's removed the obsession to drink. As I said, when I started getting sober, I was staying on my own. I was living in welfare. You know, I was on the verge of having my house repossessed. Because when I was drinking, I wouldn't pay anybody. You know, why spend good money paying bills when you can buy bottles of booze? You know, that was my philosophy. You know? When I think back on it now, I mean, it's scary. It really is scary. And I'm not here tonight to try and impress anyone or to try and scare anyone. When I tell you about the things that happened to me, they happened to me. During the first couple of weeks, I had managed to borrow a set of cassettes of Joe and Charlie, the big book guys. And I'm sitting at home on my own, and I'm listening to these two guys on the tape. And they're talking to me about studying the book that Andy had said. And they tell me to go through, and they explain it line by line. They tell me to underline the parts that are relevant to me. And some of the things they were talking about on the tape, I'd read these things 50, 100, 200 times. But listening to the two guys explaining it, it really began to make sense. Then I started beating myself up again, reproaching myself. How did I not think of that? You know? Incredible. During that time as well, we managed to get hold of a little catalogue of a place over here. It was in Brownwood in Texas, a guy called Bill O'Neill, his tape library. And the guys in the group, there was only four of us at the time. You know, I was the fourth member of the very first big book study group in the west of Scotland. And we were all on welfare. But every month we put a few pounds together, and we'd send this guy in America, and we'd maybe order 10 or 20 cassettes, and the guy would send us 30 or 40 for the same price, you know. Fabulous stuff. And I get the job of, you know, because I lived on my own, because the other guys, they had wives and families and jobs, not jobs, but wives and families. You know, whenever I got the tape sent to me, the other guys would buy the blank tapes, and I would sit at home 16 hours a day recording, making copies of them for all the guys in the group. Then it expanded to other groups, and then all over the place. But I remember, I'm only 2 weeks sober. 2 weeks. The head case had gone in and out for 12 years, and I'm 2 weeks sober. And I'm standing in the main street of the town that I grew up in, the town that I lived in. And I'm standing talking to a guy. He wasn't an AA member. It was just a feeling I had. And I can't explain it any more or any better than I'm doing right now. It was just a quiet feeling that came over me. And I knew that I would never drink again. I knew it. Over the years I've been sober, I've changed my mind. I don't believe that my God removed the obsession to drink, because that would create a vacuum. I think he replaced the obsession to drink with an obsession to stay sober and to help other people. And that's what I've been trying to do. The greatest decision I've made in my life was to turn my will and my life, that's my thoughts and my actions, over to the care of a God as I understand him. And what I did was, I knelt down in my bedroom and I read out the third step prayer, as it tells me in the book. And before we even take the third step, it says in there, the first thing we have to do is we have to quit playing God. It just doesn't work. And I was guilty of playing God for years with everybody's life. You know, my life, my wife's life. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody who was unfortunate enough to have to work with me, you know, I was always telling everybody what to do and how to do it. And I couldn't do anything about myself. So I had to quit playing God. I mean, even today, I can still be guilty at times of playing God with a good motive. But it's still playing God. You know, and thank God I know that. When it came to step four in the program, they give you the example of Mr. Brown and Mrs. Jones. And in all honesty, that did not make sense to me at that time. It didn't. But I'll show you how my God works in my life. That very first priest that I was sent to see, Father Isaac McLaren, he lived in a place called Hamilton, which is about 25, 30 miles away. By the time I'm ready to take the third and fourth steps, Father McLaren had been transferred by the Catholic Church to a chapel less than a mile from where I lived. And he was still sober. And I went down and spoke to Isaac. And at that time, in our area, they'd started handing out the Joe and Charlie four-step inventory guides. And I was telling Isaac about that. And Isaac had never seen it either. And Isaac said, you know, well, all right. He said, let's see what it says in the book about the four-step. And don't take my word for it. Go home and check it. In there it says that you might not overcome drinking till you tell someone else all your life story. And that part, all your life story, is in italics. That means it's important. And he said to me, he said, if you're looking for advice in the fourth step, he said, I would assume that you've taken the third step. I said, yep. He said, okay, how did you do it? And I told him in my bedroom on my knees. He said, do you mind if we do it again together? So the two of us knelt down and we said the third step prayer. When I stood up, he said, well, if you are sincere about the decision you've just made in step three, he said, by now you should be trusting in God. Saying if you trust in God, you will not allow anything bad to happen to you. And he said to me, do you believe that? And at that time, no, I didn't believe it. But I wanted to believe it. And you know, and in chapter 5, it says that we stood at the turning point. That's step 3. We stood at the turning point. We asked his care and protection with complete abandon. So he's going to care for us and he's going to protect us. He explained to me that there are four me's in the fourth step. I'd never heard anybody saying that before, and I haven't heard anybody saying it since. But he explained to me that there are four me's in the fourth step. And he said, it's not the nice, be quiet family man that you wanted everybody to think that you were. And I can identify with that one. He said, it's not the genius that you believed in your own mind that you were. And I could identify with that one. And he said, it's not the right bastard that you believed in your own heart that you were. And I knew that one well. He said, no, he said, we have to find the real me. The real me. And that's the one that comes through forgiveness. And hopefully that's the one that's standing here tonight. But that day he said to me, he said, Willie, I don't want you to tell me anything. He said, I want you to go home and get a writing pad and start writing down everything you can remember up to you were 15. And again, I remember saying to him, like, wait a wee minute, pal. I didn't start drinking until I was about 22. He just smiled. He said, look, go home and get a writing pad and write down everything you can remember up to you were 15. He said, and it's not a race. It took me a few weeks to write down the first episode. You know, the various instances from my childhood onwards that come back to my mind. I would just jot them down, and then I could expand on them later on. Whenever I went down and shared all that with him, he said to me, okay, he said, now I want you to continue doing the same thing with the rest of your life in 5-year cycles. And he said, now you worked in the gambling industry for years. I said, yep. He said, okay. He said, I'll have a bet with you right now. He said, I have no idea the things that you might tell me that happened in your life after you were 15, when you left school and you got married and you went to London. He said, I'll have a bet with you right now that it's just a repetition of everything you did in the first 15 years of your life. And again, I remember looking at him and thinking, are you in for a surprise, pal? The things I've done. But you know, he was dead right. He was dead right. Because up to the age of 15, I was a thief and a liar and a cheat and a con artist and a people pleaser. And I used and abused people right, left and centre. Women in particular, with no thought or consideration for their feelings and emotions. And I'm sure you can understand that. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of guy I was. You know, I know today I was never punished for my sins. I was punished by my sins. And I had to learn to stop beating myself up. It took me quite a wee while to finish off the rest of my inventory. I decided to share my fifth step with Andy Davison, the guy that introduced me to his book. And Andy came to my house on a Sunday morning. And even before Andy arrived, I was still a bit apprehensive and nervous, because there were certain things that I'd done in my life that I vowed I will never share with another living human being. I'll take them to the grave with me first. And you know, the night of my last drink, I nearly did that. I was ready to put a rope around my neck and finish it, because I just didn't want to go on. There was nothing left to go on for. I'd lost everything. But Andy came that morning, and I thank God for Andy Davison, because before I got a chance to tell Andy anything, Andy opened up and he started telling me in great depth about some of the things that he'd done. And that's what gave me the courage and the confidence to go on and admit the exact nature of my wrongs. That session lasted about 6 hours, and it was a long, physically, emotionally draining session. But I remember to this day how I felt at the end of it. From the wee guy that was nervous and apprehensive before Andy came, once I had finished, I wanted to run out and tell everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, I've taken the fifth step. You know, I heard an old guy called Chuck Chamberlain. And if none of you have read his book, A New Pair of Glasses, do yourself a favour. I heard Chuck Chamberlain describing it, and he says that it felt like an inside shower. You know, and I felt clean for the first time in my life. Clean on the inside as well as the outside. And it's a feeling that I still enjoy. It's incredible. It's fabulous. Some program. I never ever set out at any time, trust me, to try and memorise any parts of this book with the intention of going to the meetings to try and impress the troops. Never did that. But over the time I've been sober, for all the years I've been studying this book and taking other people through it, you know, line by line, page by page, there are vast chunks of this book are engraved in there and in there. Now, I can't tell you what page it's on, but you know, if you're in a big book study meeting with me, don't misquote it. That's it. Step 6 and 7 in this program, it's no big deal. It's only about 8 lines. You know, it says after we've taken the fifth step, it says when we return home we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, you know, then taking the book down from the shelf, we constructively review the first 5 proposals. Have we left anything out? And step 6 and 7 is just a prayer. It says, my Creator, I am now willing that you shall follow me, the good and the bad. And I pray that you now remove from me every single difficulty and defect that stands in the way of my usefulness to you, my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Then it says, we have now completed step 7. 6 and 7. It's only 8 lines. It's no big deal. These steps are meant to be worked quickly. It tells you that in the book as well. You know, step 6 says we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. By that time, after having done a very thorough fourth and fifth steps, I can assure you I was entirely ready to have God remove all my defects of character. Do I think he could? In a heartbeat. Step 7 says, we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Do I think he will? No, I don't. You see, I believe that my God took away the obsession for me to drink. My God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself. I couldn't get rid of that. My defects of character and shortcomings, I believe today, that God will not do anything for me that he hasn't already given me the ability to do for myself. And isn't that what it says in the Serenity Prayer that we read out? The courage to change the things we can. I've still got every single defect of character and shortcoming that I had 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But thank God today they're not nearly as bad as what they were. And I'm still working on it. And I try and live this way of life every day. And I fail every day. But I keep trying. Because that's what I'm asked to do. Came to the eighth step. And I remember saying to Andy Davison, Andy, I can't do that. Because in the eighth step it says, we made a list of all the people we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I said, Andy, I wish they'd left out the last word, all. I said, because there's one guy that I vowed, I'll never make amends to this guy. Going back to 1971, I told you about the car accident I had and the priest that gave me the last rites. We became really good friends for years after that. We became good drinking pals after that. He would come out to my house two or three nights a week. He'd open the briefcase and come out with a bottle of whiskey and a little white bit of plastic would come off and get chucked in the corner. I'd come out with a bottle of whiskey and we'd start drinking. And the number of nights that we've left my house 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he'd get in his car to drive 70 miles away to where he was stationed, and I would get in my car legless to follow him to make sure he got home alright. You know, two of us weren't fit to stand. And I don't mean now and again. This was a regular thing, week in and week out. But there was a madness in my methods, because as I'm pulling him to take him home, I had another bottle of whiskey in the glove compartment. You know. As I say, we became very good friends. That guy married my wife after we got divorced. And I knew for quite a few months, I suspected there was something going on. I remember driving down to where he was one day and I took him outside in the garden and I told him right to his face. This is when I was drinking. If I ever see you again in this area, I'll put this car right over the effing top of you. And my family knew the violence that this big guy was capable of. I'm not proud when I tell you that the last few years of my mother's life, she ended up in abject fear that I would end up doing a life sentence for killing that guy. And I said to Andy, you know, Andy, I can't do this. I'll never make amends to him. And Andy said, well, Willie, I said, pray for him. Pray for him. I remember looking at Andy and I said, pray for him? I'd bury him in my front garden. And Andy said, well, it's up to you, you'll drink again. And that really stopped me short, because I didn't ever want to go back to the hell that I'd come out of. And I started praying for the guy. And I didn't mean it at first, but I kept doing it. And the longer I kept doing it, you know, the more I did begin to mean it. And I would ask my God to give this man the same blessings that he'd given me. He died a few years ago. And before he died, I got the chance to make direct amends to him, face to face. We'll get to that. Step 9 talks about, you know, making amends to such people wherever possible. It doesn't say whenever possible. It says wherever possible. And I believe that my God decides the wherever. That if I've got an amend to make to someone, my God will bring the two of us together face to face at some point. Then it's up to me to go forward It's not about running around knocking on doors saying, I'm sorry. I said that a million times, never meant it once. It's a different ball game today. It took me another hour to tell you some of the amends I had to make. Most people accepted it with good grace. But a lot of them said, "Now you just get the F out here and don't come back. We've had enough of you." I remember one instance, I went down to the local police station because my conscience was bothering me about some of the things I'd done in my past. And I'm standing there with the desk sergeant and I'm rhyming it all off to this big guy. And he's standing there like that. And he let me go on and on. And he said, "Well, are you done?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "If you think I'm going to stand here and write all that out in a statement," he said, "you're joking. Just get the hell out of here and don't go back." And I've never seen him since. Step 10. You know, they asked me just to look for four things: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And that's the things I found in the four step. And it tells me what to do with them. And that covers step 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. You know, it's an incredible program. And it's no big deal. And if this program can work for somebody like me, it'll work for anybody. You know, step 11 talks about prayer and meditation. To me, that is just talking to my God and listening to Him. And I talk to my God just the way I'm speaking to you. I don't go in for a lot of ritualized prayers. There's a few that I use, like the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the prayer of St. Francis. There's another one I use on a regular basis. It's a guy called St. Augustine. We call him St. Augustine, but you all call him St. Augustine. And if you've ever read his book, The True Confessions of St. Augustine, he was one of us. This guy, you know, his life was wine, women, and song. That was it. He was one of us. But every night before he went to bed, he would kneel down and he would say, "Father, make me a saint, but not yet." Step 12 is one of the reasons why I'm here tonight. But I'm going to back up a wee bit. I told you about the guy that married my wife, the priest. You can only imagine the amount of anger and hatred and bitterness I had against not only him, but against the whole of the Catholic Church. And again, I thank God for this book, because that helped to put that into perspective for me as well. Because in there, part of it says that we beg you to lay aside any prejudice you may have, even against organized religions, that we may pick out the wrongdoings of one or two individuals and use that as a basis of wholesale condemnation of them all. And that's what I've been doing. I thank God for this book. I started coming over here on vacation in 1991. I've been coming over here now for 21 years. And I would come over twice a year. I'd come for the whole month of July. Then I'd come back again just before Christmas and stay for 3 months. That's expensive. But you see, after I get sober, you know, my God's got a funny sense of humour. I never saw my three kids for years and years because we were divorced, my ex-wife. She wouldn't even give me any photographs of my own kids growing up. So what I did was, in the early days of my sobriety, I bought a cheap little plastic camera out of the chemist shop. I think it cost about $15. And every weekend I would take pictures of whenever I saw them. I take pictures of my own two daughters for me. I never thought for a second, never in a million years, that I would end up working as a professional photographer all over Britain. You know, but my God has got a funny sense of humour. And my God just opens doors for me. And He puts people like you in front of me. And it's up to me to go forward and just be myself. No airs or graces, just be me. The real me. You know? I love to make the guys in AA jealous when I tell you. For 15 years, I was the official photographer at all the big dancing competitions all over Britain. All the Scottish Highland, the Irish, the disco, the ballroom, Latin American. I've photographed some of the most beautiful looking women and girls all over the country. And at times, they had hardly any clothes on. And they paid me. Don't tell me God hasn't got a sense of humour. You know, the kind of guy I was when I was drinking, your granny wouldn't have been safe. But you know, in 1994, I was over here for 3 months in the winter, and I went back home to Scotland. And I went to the usual Monday night meeting that I went to. I've been going for years. And I knew everybody in the room. This particular night, there was a big guy sitting there in the corner on his own, and I went down and stuck my hand out and introduced myself. And as soon as he opened his mouth and I heard the American accent, he said, "My name is John." And I said, "Are you here on vacation, John?" And he said, "No." I said, "I'm here as part of my job." So of course the next question is, "What do you work at?" He said, "I'm a Catholic priest." And that night he asked me if I would sponsor him. And Jim's met him. And Rich has met him. And he comes and visits. He's back up in Washington, D.C. now. You know, and he comes and stays with me now and again. And John's about 37 years sober now. And anytime, I've spoken to him just the other night. Anytime I speak to John, the one thing we never talk about is religion. We talk about AA. You know, this is where I found my God. It's incredible. You know, that could only happen in AA. Take you back to... Thanks for the 2 hours, by the way. I'm just getting wound up, pal. You made a big mistake asking me to come and speak. And the people in this room could verify it. Anyway, take you back to the summer of 1998. I hadn't seen my two daughters or my son for a good 10, 12 years. But during the summer of 98, I got a letter from my youngest daughter. Her name is Geraldine, telling me that she was a patient in a psychiatric hospital not far from where I lived. I'm going to come and see her. I was in the hospital within an hour, and when I saw her, I didn't even recognize her. She was like something out of Biafra. She had been a nurse, and she'd injured her back lifting one of the patients, which is a common complaint with nurses. Since then, she was put on different painkillers, and she had all sorts of scans and tests and x-rays and what have you. And she became addicted to prescription drugs. She never did street drugs. Eventually she signed herself out of that hospital. And when I went to the hospital, even the doctors and the staff, they wouldn't tell me anything about my daughter because of this doctor-patient confidentiality. And I'm saying to them, "I'm her dad." "Sorry, pal, we can't tell you." Whenever she got out of hospital, swear to God, for the next 6 months, my business came to a standstill. And I spent as much of my time, either every day or every evening, in Geraldine's home, or she would come to my house. And I'm trying to get through it to her, and I couldn't get her to open up. And she would just say, "But Dad, you know, I don't feel safe. And I don't enjoy peace of mind or happiness." And I couldn't get anything else out of her. That went on for 6 months. On the 2nd of January, 1999, and it was a Saturday night, and I was asked to speak at a meeting not far from where I lived. And I remember I told the people in the room, a lot of them knew about my daughter, because they'd met her. But I'm telling them that particular night, you know, that I had to admit that I was powerless over Geraldine, that she made my life unmanageable. And that I'd come to believe that only a power greater than me could restore her to sanity. And I made a decision that night, in front of everybody, to turn her will and her life over to the care of my God, as I understood him. That was the Saturday night, the 2nd of January, 99. On a Tuesday afternoon, I got a phone call, and the voice in the phone said, "It's me." I said, "Who's me?" He said, "It's Liam, your son." I hadn't spoken to my son in 15 years. He said, "Dad, just to let you know that Geraldine hanged herself last night." That was a Tuesday afternoon. I assumed that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Monday night. My ex-wife had gone away to the house. Geraldine's car was there. The dog was barking. But my wife couldn't get in because Geraldine wouldn't give her a key. So eventually they got the cops and they broke the door down. That's when they found her. Again, I assumed that she'd hanged herself on the Monday night. It wasn't until the Wednesday when we got the autopsy report that said that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Saturday night. The night I had turned her will and her life over to the care of God. And I thank God for EE at that time, because my house was full every day and every night with loads of EE people and some of my own family. You see, it would come 11, 12 o'clock at night and they would all go home because they've got their own families and jobs and what have you. But you know, for all the years I've been coming over here on vacation, knowing the number of people that I knew over here, when it's midnight in Scotland, it's 7 o'clock in the evening over here. And I'd be on the phone every night of the week for hours. I didn't care how much it cost. And I'd call some of my friends here in Orlando, Father John up in Washington DC, Joe Kelly and his wife Deborah down in Naples. And I needed all that support that I had. You know, and the one thing I will say is that during all that madness that went on at that time, and you don't even know the half of it, but during all that chaos that was going on in my life, my God allowed me to conduct myself with dignity and decency. And I didn't have to drink over it. Why do I tell you these things? Is it looking for sympathy? No, it's not. The point is that if I can go through stuff like this, any of you can. I've got a little piece of paper I've had in here for years. For the next 12 months, it seemed as though I'd been hit by a series of express trains. I'd so many of my relatives and friends all died. Some of them committed suicide, some of them died of alcoholism, some of them died of cancer. It was incredible. Just one right after the other for the next 12 months. I remember at times, you know, back home in Scotland, one day in particular, I'm walking down the main street. There was an AA member, he spotted me, and he shouted, "Willie, how are you doing after your daughter committed suicide?" And I could have belted the guy. You know, but if that's sobriety, you can keep it. Unbelievable, some of the things I've been through. But you know, as I said earlier, somebody up there likes me. And I'm still here. I'm still sober. And that brings me to the 12th step in this program. That's the reason why I'm here tonight. Because in there it says, you know, that having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. The result of the steps is a spiritual awakening. And I've had many, many spiritual awakenings. But then they asked me to do something very specific. They asked me to try and carry this message. Not the message. This message. And again, at the beginning, I didn't know what this message was. And Andy showed it to me. And this is a third edition of the book. And it's there up halfway down. It says, "This is a basic text, new and revised. The pages 1 to 164 remains unchanged." Then it says, "This is the AA message." That's the message I'm asked to carry. In the fourth edition, I don't know if you know this or not, in the fourth edition, they've changed that. They changed it to pages 1 to 164 was the AA message. Did you know that? They are now in the process of changing it back again to this. That's fact. If I don't know what it says in this book, and I haven't applied these things into my life, how in the name of God can I try and carry this message? It can't be done. You see, then it goes on to ask me to practice principles in all my affairs. I used to think that word affairs meant affairs. You know, it doesn't. You see, when I was drinking, I lived by my own principles. And the principles I lived by were, you know, if at first you don't succeed, cheat. Another one was, honesty is the best poverty. When I was drinking, I was very generous with other people's money. I can assure you. I say every bookmaker that I work for, I robbed them blind. But you know, I became an expert at rationalising and justifying my own behaviour, because I had to be able to do that to live with myself. And these bookmakers that I worked for, they were the guys with all the money, and I was the guy with all the brains. And if they would have paid me what I was really worth, I wouldn't have had to have stolen off them, you know. And all the different women that I jumped around with, if my ex-wife would have been the kind of woman that she should have been, I wouldn't have had to have done those things. It was never my fault for anything I did, you know. That's how sick I was. Thank God Willie's not sick today. You know, today for me, I just try and lead a clean, decent, honest life. It's no big deal. And it's a hell of a lot easier trying to lead a clean, decent, honest life than it was the kind of life I'd been leading previously. You know, it's incredible. You know, I often wonder, what would the co-founders say if they were in this room tonight? Somehow I can hear Dr. Silkworth saying that I urge every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps you came to scoff, you may remain to pray. I can hear Bill Wilson saying, if you're an alcoholic who wants to go over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Then he says, it's the purpose of this book to answer these questions specifically. I can hear Dr. Bob, the quiet man in AA, I can hear him saying, if you think you're an atheist or an agnostic or a skeptic or suffer from any other form of intellectual pride which prevents you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. And I would like to add, and so do I. I'm going to wind this up. You'll be glad. I'm going to wind it up by using the words of Father Isaac McLaren, who became my sponsor. And every time Isaac spoke at a meeting, he would always end by saying that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't come into existence to make life easy, but it did come into existence to make men and women great. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you for listening to me tonight, because tonight again, I feel great. Thank you.